is the 15th of August. I am in Copper Center with John Devins Jr. And John, I know nothing except for the few little things that you have just now told me about your involvement with the oil spill. So if you could tell me your story, I am here to hear it.
Well, the oil spill hit.
You were living where?
I was living in Valdez, commercial fishing the year before, and had been out of work all winter, so the oil spill hit just right before long lining season was supposed to kick off. It sounded like a really good job. So we all showed up at the courthouse to sign up, two days later. And I think fishermen were out there laying boom before that, but they hadn't sent a crew out yet. Mm-hmm. And so they came in, they signed up a little over 100 of us on that first crew.
And that you're talking about Vico.
Yeah, for Vico.
Yeah.
And of course then, because of the situation, you know, he cracked up on the rocks because, you know, he'd been drinking kind of thing. We all got UA'd. Mm-hmm. Well, in Valdez in the wintertime, you can pretty much count on anybody who hasn't been working for Alyeska or the city isn't going to pass a UA.
Sure.
So we were all kind of a little bit worried about that. The first few days, we just sat on a bus. And then, you know, a bunch of reporters started getting pictures of us just sitting on a bus all day. So then they decided, well, they'll get us out on a boat. So we went out on the Glacier Queen. But then we just rode around for a few days.
And what's the reason for
we didn't have anything to work with.
I see.
There was nothing we could do other than
there was no response equipment.
There was nothing for us to work with.
Yeah.
But they had to get us away from the reporters in town.
Yeah.
And they were very adamant about it. If any of us talked to a reporter, we were finished that moment. Those were clear and explicit orders. If we talked to a reporter, we were finished for Vico.
Okay.
So then they got us out on the Glacier Queen, which kind of curtailed that because none of the reporters were really making it out there. And so we just cruised around for a few days. But then they started getting, the reporters especially, started getting out on helicopters and charter boats and started getting pictures of us doing a bunch more nothing. So the best that they could come up with was they came up with a bunch of oil absorbent material rags. And they put us off on Naked Island and we started wiping off rocks and bagging up all this stuff. It was, you know, incredibly ineffective. We weren't really getting anything done. We were just killing our days.
Yeah.
But it was almost $17 an hour. So however they want me to kill days at $17 an hour in the 80s, that was just fine.
Right.
But you know, we weren't really getting anything done. You know, we were just sitting on the beach cleaning, just wiping rocks off with these glorified paper towels, basically.
And then the tide would come back
in. And then the tide would come back in. We tried other experiments. They took a crew of us. I was on that crew. They took a crew of us over, and we had, the idea was, because the oil had gotten whipped up into this mousse, and it looked just like chocolate pudding, about 2 or 3 foot thick, and it was rolling up on the beaches like that. So somebody had the idea we dug several ditches about 100 or so foot long. And the idea was that the waves would come up, fill these up with that stuff. We would scoop it into these oil containment bags and get it all cleaned up and clean up a lot more oil that way. Well, that didn't work. Every wave brought in 10 times more than we had cleaned up in the last 2 hours. You know, so that got pretty frustrating. So we quit that. We did that like one day. And then we quit that and then did a bunch more riding around and just rock polishing, you know, kind of thing. But the weather out there and the sound in the spring can be, you know, pretty hit and miss.
Mm-hmm.
And it got nasty out there a few times. Once the task force really started getting built up, and every night we were going back into Valdez, but then they got some cruise ships in that we could stay on. And that was pretty good duty. I mean, you know, those were pretty plush accommodations. You know, these are these tour ships out of California.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we started staying out there, then, you know, they started making a lot more of a show out of it. But we were staying out there and then just going out to the job sites and polishing rocks just from those cruise ships until the very first landing craft came on, and it had a Dutz pump to the bolted to the front of it, and we'd pull up on a beach and we did the first test with the hoses.
Mm-hmm.
And
the hot water hose.
No, at that time we weren't using hot water then. It was just straight seawater.
Mm-hmm.
We were pumping it out of the ocean up into these dutzes and shooting it through these manifolds that everybody got a hose, and you just stirred the sand up on the beach.
Just For out of curiosity, how do I spell Dukes? Is that
Dukes? Dukes, it's D-U-E-T-Z.
That's what I was
thinking. It's a brand name.
Okay, good.
It's a two-cycle water pump.
Okay.
They run generators, stuff like that, you know, whatever you hook to them.
Yeah.
And so the first crew, and we did that for a couple of days, and, you know, it looked like, well, you know, at least it was making a big show. I mean, that whole project was simply evaluated on how bad a spanking Exxon took. I mean, we really never cleaned up very much out there. French skimmers didn't work. The French steamers didn't really work. When we hit it with hot water, we were basically doing as much or more damage than the oil ever did. Because we cooked everything that was still left alive on the beach and washed it out into the tide. And, you know, so it, yeah, you know, I mean, as long as it was a big show, you know, I mean, as long as the helicopters could go by and there was all kinds of activity and stuff going on, most people didn't know whether it was effective or not,
right.
You know, and so just and as long as we were way busy.
Exxon could claim that they were doing this big cleanup.
Well, yeah, that whole thing turned into just, you know, it was evaluated on the amount of dollars and man hours that were spent, not on the actual results of the cleanup, because I don't think we cleaned up very much at all. And then towards the end, we were just, you know, we were just making more of a show.
Okay.
What's what we always called it, especially once I got up towards foreman, it was just the show.
Yeah.
And you made crews just walk back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, because when they're getting surveyed from a boat on the beach, nobody really knows what they're doing. They're just active, not a big crew just standing around doing nothing, you know.
So at a certain point, you became promoted to foreman.
Yeah. Well, you know, it became obvious that we didn't want to be regular beach workers, because that was going to be fairly tedious, grueling work.
Mm.
And I had a knowledge of the Sound. I grew up down there, you know, and my dad was a licensed skipper and ran a charter boat. So, you know, the Sound was something I really knew. So I kind of worked my way into a position where I was, had a lot of freedom. I didn't have to work. I got a skiff, because I knew how to run a skiff, and most of them that hit out there really didn't.
Uh-huh.
And so with that skiff, then, I could zip around between all these other landing crafts, and I just kind of filled my own role in keeping everybody working. You know, there was never enough stuff, especially in the beginning. There was never enough rain gear, gloves, rubber boots. People were working without protection, and it was just drizzling and cold and horrible. And so I was what they called a scrounger. I had a skiff, and I would go, and then when people had extra stuff, if they didn't want to trade, when they weren't looking, I just took it to where it was needed. Some of the boats would get stranded, you know, because we were trying to pull up onto the beach, and if they got stuck and had a bunch of equipment there and they weren't going to get out for a few days, then I'd take the skiff and tools by, and I'd strip the whole ship, everything that wasn't welded to the deck, the pumps, the fittings, the hoses, everything, and take it over to another boat and get it going and mm-hmm. supply them. Tools were in real short supply, and so when I got tagged for foremanship, it was based on actually one particular day. Somebody from Houston, the powers that be, flew over the task force and was fairly unimpressed, because those big landing crafts, they were paying $100 a foot, you know, and some of them were 100 and something feet a day, you know, and so they were making, you know, $6,000-$10,000 a day, and they're just sitting at anchor all week. So he flew over and he said, any ship that wasn't working by, I don't know, he gave whatever time it was like next week, their contract's canceled. So then everything hit high gear, and everybody's just screaming for stuff, but there just wasn't enough stuff.
Yeah.
And the stuff that there was very heavily guarded on the barge,
mm-hmm.
and I was constantly sneaking on and pilfering rubber boots and raincoats and gloves for the crew and stuff like that, and to the point where the barge man said, if I see you pull up empty again, I'm cutting you loose, Devins. But this one particular day, to get one boat working that a friend of mine from up the road was foreman of. I hadn't even made foreman yet. I was still just running around doing my thing. And he needed a banding gun to put hoses together. And with it, because we constructed our own hoses right there, and they ran out onto the beach, and then they could get to work and stuff. But there was only 3 banding guns for the whole entire task force. And there's 100 ships out there. You know, bow pickers and everything else. But yeah, there's only 3 banding guns in the whole place, and they were jealously guarded by everybody. Well, I found out who had one. But I didn't have anything he wanted to trade. What he really wanted was a bunch of pipe wrenches, because those were in really short supply. And you can't, you know, tighten up all the fittings and stuff on those Dutz pumps without a bunch of that kind of stuff. I actually knew where to get some of those, but he wasn't interested in the least in a banding gun. What he really needed was gasoline, because almost everything out there ran on diesel. So there was a lot of diesel out there. But all the skiffs and those Dutz pumps ran off of gasoline primarily. And there was never enough gas, especially for the skiffs. And so I had to do a little rigmarole, and I went over to the barge and went up in the Vico barge. Had just been vacated by Price, Norcon had just been vacated by Norcon. There was a big fight. Norcon was the union side of the task force out there, and Vico was the non-union, and so there was a lot of friction and stuff going. So I went up and I talked to Bob, and I told him I really need to, you know, get this squared away. How can I possibly do it? And he says, I don't know. You know, Norcon, when they took off of this barge, they took all that crap with them. And stuff, and I don't know if it's over on Norcon. How do I get up on the Norcon barge? He had no idea, but he did say the only thing I can help you out with, he says, here in their break room, which was a Connex, they had left a bunch of those patches, Norcon patches that go on your hard hat. So I took one of those patches and I peeled it off and I put it over my Vico patch. Got back on the bow picker, went over to the Norcon barge, and just mostly nobody out there knew who had authority at all. If you acted like you had what they called the stroke, then they acted like you had the stroke. So I just walked up, had a wad of papers in my hands. I don't even think they were anything. I think it was mail from home, actually. And I pointed at the two drums of gas there, and they loaded it for me with their own crane. And I got that on board, took that over, and I traded that for the knack box that had, a big knack box that had all these pipe wrenches in it. So I took those pipe wrenches, and I took a few out because there was a lot of pipe wrenches in there, and Donnie didn't need all of them. So I took a few of those out because I was trade those later. Took that knack box over and traded it to Donnie, still a buddy of mine down in Valdez, the banding gun.
Spell knack.
K-N-A-C-K.
Okay.
It's a brand name. And so then I took the banding gun over to Dan Saylor's on the ski lack and gave it to him. When I got to him, he said... Well, they called me JD out there because there was like six Johns. And he says, I don't know what you did. I don't want to know what you did, but you're bleeding like all over the radio. He said, go find a nice quiet cove and take the rest of the day off. The next day they called me up and they said, wow, you got a boat running in one afternoon. That's pretty amazing. And so they made me foreman. And then after that, it got even more interesting. But
so once you got to be foreman, what... I mean, I know you would probably just tell me quickly what types of legitimate activities you were in charge of.
Well, at first, as foreman, I eventually made general foreman. Mm-hmm. But it was on Task Force 1, what they were doing was they were developing one crew that just laid boom for everybody. Mm-hmm. Up until right when I made it there. To that point, all the boats were doing their own booming. You know, and they'd boom off an area, then they'd shoot the beach, try and collect the oil, bring a French skimmer in, try and skim it off. You know, they ended up with 500 gallons of seawater, and that was basically it. And so they were going to have, and so it was going to be more controlled. And then you'd have skiff people that would open and close these boom gates, you know, for traffic back and forth, and we'd get more beach done. Or that was the plan anyway. So they were forming up a boom crew, and it turned out to be the largest crew on Task Force 1, and we set boom for all the entire task force. And then when we broke down from a work site, then we had to collect all that boom, load it, and move it over to the next work site. Nobody could really get working until we had boomed off the beach that we got working on.
One quick question. what do you remember approximately what time it was that you made foreman?
Oh, it was after the bad weather. The seals had just, or the sea lions had just started hauling up, and it was after we were on Seal Island.
So maybe like...
Because I almost quit, you know, because I thought, I saw a lot of people that were making foreman ahead of me, and it was kind of bugging me, you know, because of some of these people I had trained, you know, once they got out there.
So if it was just after the bad weather, then we're talking like a week into the spill?
Or? Oh, no, more like a month.
Okay.
At least.
Okay. All right, that's
full
timeline.
Yeah, at least that. Okay. And, you know, like I said, I'd been running around for a couple of tours. I skipped an R&R. I didn't want to go out on R&R because I didn't want to take another UA, you know.
Yeah.
We were all worried about that. In fact, at one point, they called us up when we were digging those ditches and working real hard on the beach like that. They called us up, and I don't want to go into that.
Yeah, we're going to tell.
I thought I was fired that day, but I wasn't. I was just being sent back to the boat because they figured I could work without being supervised. But I thought my UA had come in and I was canned.
Yeah, no.
Actually, they didn't can anybody because of their UAs.
Yeah, okay.
They couldn't because they had only had, out of that first 127 that we sent out, they'd had, 97% failed their UAs.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
On that. And,
okay. All right, so... Okay, so now you've roughly described what your job description was. So what else did you do?
Pretty much whatever we were told. You know, you get kind of caught up in it, and if they like you, you can write your own ticket and you could do whatever you wanted to. I mean, there was no curfew for me. You know, there was security on the ships, but... You know, once I kind of got in with those guys and they liked me, they liked my work, and I could get things done if they just gave me enough rope.
Yeah. Sounds like
you know, kind of thing. It was a chaotic situation, you know, and it was no place, you know, the task force out there was no place to play by the rules. If you played by the rules, you got nothing done. You just sat around doing nothing.
Right.
You know, you had to really scramble, and they liked that.
Yeah.
You know, and they liked that about me, and... you know, so, and it is, it's kind of cool. You know, now I look back on it with a little bit of regret, but, you know, it was, you get caught up in it, and, you know, you do a better job, you know, their kind of job, and...
And hey, you were 18 years younger.
Well, yeah, I was only like 21 or something like that, but, you know, and all of a sudden, I've got a 120-man crew, and, you know, I'd never been in a position like that before, and then, of course, you know, the regular... beachcombers, you know, they were herded like cattle, you know, I mean, from one boat into the next boat and onto the beach and strung out, you know, and I didn't want to work like that. You know, I'd grown up in Alaska commercial fishing and, you know, I wasn't really much of a factory worker type. So I really didn't want to end up on the beach.
Yeah.
So I did a good job with a bunch of other stuff. And like I said, I mean, it's like, I don't know, when you get taken under their wing, then, you know, it's kind of comfortable.
Right.
You know, you just, you know, you can go in the kitchen and pilfer, whereas anybody else caught behind there, they're heading back to the beat or back to Valdez, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
You know, just security didn't mess with me. After I got into it a little while, I came back from R&R, and they just randomly singled me out to search my bags. And Warren, the second highest guy on Task Force 6, came in and said, "Oh no, you don't have to mess with his bags." And she was like, "Well, I'm halfway through it. We might as well finish." And they sent her back the next morning to Valdez. I don't think she got fired. She just got reassigned, though.
Uh-huh.
You know, stuff like that.
My
own room. I didn't have to bunk with anybody.
The second highest guy that intervened. The second highest guy in what?
On the task force.
Oh, okay.
There was Big Bob. I don't remember his last name, but mm-hmm. Bob was the head of our task force,
mm-hmm.
and split off onto the, you know, the other task forces too.
Uh-huh.
And then right under him was Warren,
mm-hmm.
and he was the only man that I answered to.
Okay.
And I don't remember Warren's last name.
So there came a point in the summer when, on top of all of these other things that you needed to do, you were asked to do, to buy some, move around some booze?
Well, because of the, that is true. And it was because the task force
I don't think that's even illegal. I mean,
It was definitely supposed to be against the rules out there because of, you know, the whole Hazelwood thing. But actually, you know, if you're a maritimer, Hazelwood didn't do anything that isn't being done every single solitary day. He left a third mate in charge, and that is perfectly acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Drinking at dinner time on a ship is it's still a, it's a hundreds and hundreds of year old custom that officers in the Navy, I think, even still get to do. Yeah. You know, so I mean, his big mistake was he didn't follow the rules and he ran up on a rock. He should have just stayed there. Yeah. That's the number one rule. If you hit a rock, you don't move. That may be the only thing holding you up.
Yeah.
You know, anyway. So, yeah, because I had the boom crew, most of the boats were assigned to me or to my crew and stuff. And so, yeah, we would go in and just load up in Whittier. We didn't go near Valdez for that action. We went into a little quiet place in Whittier, and there's a little place right down by the harbor, Joe's, and a Korean guy named Joe owned that. And we would go in there, and we would load up and then bring it out, put it in these cargo nets, you know, like a fishing web for seiners or whatever, put a 55-pound hook on it and sink it down. And then about 5 or 6 feet from the top where the buoy is, we would shackle that cargo net so it's down underneath the water until after work. And then it just looks like anchor buoys. Because when we were set up on a site, you know, the boats would just set down a permanent anchor buoy, you know, so they didn't have to pull their anchor every day. And then they just come in and tie off to their buoy at night. And also pull it up about 5 feet and get out what you wanted to drink that night and then throw it back down.
Right. And for who was the booze for?
That was for what we call the white hats. That was for the Exxon guys, well, and for me. I got to hang with them. When we were far into the oil spill, a lot of the girls got to hang with them, too. And we had formed a special detachment for the good-looking girls out there because they didn't want them holding hoses all day and coming in all crapped out from the beach. So we put them on skiffs opening and closing these gates. It was real nice, easy duty. They got to tan a little bit while they were doing it. And they weren't too wore out and grubby to go party in the evening.
Right.
And so, in essence, well, the guy that was, I had a foreman that was in charge of that, but he was basically running the harem.
Very good.
The girlfriends.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, yeah, I think we mostly probably partied every night.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that it makes total sense to me.
And that's why, you know, security, when they saw one of us coming, they just looked the other way.
Yeah.
And if they ever said anything, it was like that one woman that searched my bag, she'd end up on the beach.
Yeah. Okay, now tell me the story about the illegal disposal of batteries.
Well, it wasn't batteries, it was boom.
Oh, boom, okay.
It was boom. Right. When we left, I think it was Sleepy Bay. We'd done a 27-hour shift that day. We had to pull in all a mile and a half or 2 miles of boom. And you couldn't drag any of it anywhere. You know, you couldn't just hook on and tow it. I mean, this stuff floated pretty good. And we loaded and loaded and loaded. Like I said, I personally had a 27-hour shift in that shift. And then I left it to one of my foremans to get the last little bit out. And I called it a day and went in. Well, they called me up the next morning and just threw a shit storm. And there was still some boom left in that bay, and we were supposed to be demobbed completely, and the Coast Guard were on their way. And it was a big, huge, fat jam, and it was all my fault, basically, is how they were looking at it. And so we had already, the whole task force was over at this other site, so I took a bow picker with another general foreman, and an Exxon supervisor, and a fisherman that was running the bow picker. And there were four of us on that boat. And we went over there, and sure as hell, there was a bunch of boom still. It was all bundled up, but it was all still there. And it was just more than we knew what to do with. And so they said, we have to get rid of this shit right now. Don't care what we do. Somebody better come up with something right then and there. And so we had enough anchors that we strapped anchors to it. But see, that stuff floats.
Yeah.
And it was made to float.
Yeah.
So we had to take our knives and slice it all open. Yeah. And we just kept piling anchors and hooking anchors and hooking anchors and hooking anchors onto it until we ran out of anchors. But most of it sank to the bottom.
Yeah.
And we just kept filling up. But then, like I said, we still had a whole crap load of it left. So we were going to have to do something with it.
How much was there?
I don't know. I mean, we moved 90% of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we got on board and stuff like that.
But, you know, I mean, originally, just give me an estimate of how much material there was that you dealt with.
That we dumped?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm thinking, as if memory serves anyway, a dozen bundles.
A dozen.
And I don't know how far a bundle went anymore, but that was, I mean, it was hundreds of feet.
Okay. Each one?
No, each one was maybe, you know, in the sections that they came in and then you hooked them together, was maybe 100 feet.
Okay.
You know, and there was a dozen or 15 bundles maybe
so
left.
So we're talking about 100 to 150 feet of boom.
More like 1,000.
Oh.
Yeah, about 1,000.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay. Of that. And so, but then we just ran out of anchors, and there was still boom to go. And so at this point, the Exxon white hat, he knew he had to bail. He was so far over the line, you know, kind of thing at this point. Shit, I knew I was over the line at this point. I knew I shouldn't have been sinking that crap. So, but anyway, then we stuck. So another boat came up and rescued him and the other general foreman. And they left me there to deal with the rest of it. And so I shackled the rest of the boom to the back of the bow picker that I was on. And we headed for the new task force. We just had to get there without getting seen by the Coast Guard. You know, and that was all. Which didn't happen. A C-130 flew right over us, and we're right out there around the point, and we've got, I don't know, three strands of maybe 300 foot long, 200-300 foot long, strung out behind us, and we're towing it. And they did a circle around, so we knew they saw us. So I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm going to jail. You know, at least I won't spend any money while I'm there. This last check will last me. And, but anyway, I was at, you know, at that point in charge of the boom crew. So, and we had a couple of these party boats, you know, these bass boats, you know, those platform kind of pontoon boats.
Okay.
You know, and we had, I called Elida and I said, look, don't ask me any questions. I'm in a big, huge, deep jam here. Of course, she owed me big fat favor anyway, or she'd have been back on the beach. But I told her, I said, load up that party boat with all the oil absorbent boom you can get. What we called sausage boom. I said, get it loaded up with that. And I says, you start heading towards the old task force or the old work site where the task force was. And I said, just steam away, baby, and get over there.
So she was a skipper.
No, she was a foreman.
Oh, okay.
She was a foreman, and she had a driver for that boat. Okay. And so they loaded it up, and they headed out. And because I knew the Coast Guard was within moments of swooping down on me.
So that was like an alibi. With her coming to rendezvous with you.
What we did was, yeah, I swooped into a cove, dumped that oily boom, and she started playing out a mile of that sausage boom, and I played like that's what I'd been towing from the other task force when the Coast Guard swooped down on us. It's like, and that was the only boom that was legal to tow around out there was that oil absorbent boom. And yeah, so I didn't get caught for it. I dumped that stuff in a cove behind the ski lack. Boom that off, hooked in all that Elida had brought out to me, and I just started towing that around like I'd been doing it all day long. Man.
Okay.
And I got another promotion.
then you got promoted to general foreman.
That was when I made general foreman.
And yeah, see, okay.
You're rewarded. Yeah. You're rewarded for everything.
Well, hey, you were an extremely clever guy. You know, well, Exxon needs extremely clever guys at this point. So this is like at what month in the summer that you make general?
We got to be into July now for sure.
Okay. So
maybe even towards the end of July by then. So we had moved over in front of Mummy Bay, and that's where you know, there's an old lodge down there. You know, and after this and my general foremanship, then not only did I get my own room, but then I got my own skiff driver, so then I could go over and stay at the lodge with Bernie. We weren't supposed to go near the lodge, but after work, I'd go over there because I knew some people over there, Marvin Nofke and stuff. And so I'd go over and party all night and stay the night over at the lodge. And this real lazy kid, he made no bones about being a real lazy kid. And I said, I got the job for you. You got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and get over there to the lodge with a skiff and pick me up so I'm back on the ship before I have to get the crew ready. And then I said, you can go screw around all rest of the day. That's the only thing, that's your only job. And so, yeah, they'd let me stay over at the lodge.
And he was making $19 an hour to do that.
$16 something an hour.
Yeah. So tell me the part about seeing Exxon or Vico, I guess it would be, crews hired by Vico, cleaning beaches that were not oiled.
Well, I almost have to take responsibility for that idea.
Okay, hold on just a second. I'll flip this tape. Go ahead.
At one point there in the late summer, and it had to have been, you know, mid-July, Big Bob had made a screwy statement. And they, because they were talking about, you know, this is going to take years to clean this up at the rate you guys are going. And he said, we're going to make a half mile of beach a day, which was insane. We weren't making 100 yards of clean beach a day at that point. You know, and there was no way to make that up. I mean, there just was no way. If we'd had 10 times more people out there, we couldn't have made a half mile of beach a day. It was just, or a week, or whatever his timeline was. But, yeah, it was just some astronomical thing for the press, you know. And but there was no way we were ever going to hit that. So what we started doing was, and we would boom off clean beaches mm-hmm. next to oiled beaches. Mm-hmm. And we boomed off a hell of a lot of them. And then I would take a beach crew out, and in fact, Matt still lives down the road from me. We're still kind of close. He was my lead man for this, and I'd give him about 18 or 20 guys, and all they had to do on these clean beaches was march up and down them, make a crap load of tracks, and bag up everything, driftwood, sticks, seaweed, because once it went in those oil containment bags, nobody ever looked in them. They would just went right straight to the incinerator, you know, so there could have been anything in there. Could have stashed bodies in there, you know. And so I just had them walk up and down the beach and just bag up anything that they found. Make a lot of tracks, make it look like somebody had run over the place, you know.
Anything you mean, driftwood, rocks?
Driftwood, rocks. We put a lot of rock, had them put a lot of rocks in that, lots of seaweed, you know. Just and just make it look like there had been a crew there.
Yeah.
You know, lots of tracks, you know, all that kind of stuff. Boomed off, leave some rope around. I mean,
and
they
purpose. Oh, I'm sorry. What was their attitude when? I mean, was that surprising or was that just kind of taken for granted that stuff like that would go on when you gave that order to the crew to do that? Were they surprised?
No, no, not by this point. No, no, not at all.
So the level of corruption.
Because we had already been through the Indian crews and, you know, the state slaves. That's what we called them.
Okay, let's remember to go back to that. But finish telling me about the cleanup of non-dirty beaches, and then we'll go back to the
states. Well, yeah, we just started booming off beaches that had never been oiled. And we just made a big show, you know, put a lot of commotion out there and made a lot of tracks, bagged up a lot of crap, you know, just made a big pile of bags.
Mm-hmm. Give me an estimate of how many dirty beaches you cleaned up.
Well, we started making our quota.
Okay.
Which was 10 times more than we were before. Uh-huh. And the Coast Guard would come in and sign off on these beaches. Uh-huh. And if they couldn't tell a beach that had been oiled and shot with the hoses by then they were pretty new still.
So you can't remember specifically what that quota was?
No, I think he said we were going to make a quarter mile or a half mile a day. A quarter mm-hmm. mile a day is what I think he said.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you know, it filtered down to us because then everybody, you know, just shit bricks and we're like, you know, how are we going to do this?
Right.
You know, and that was the only way, because there was no way that we were going to make.
So how long were you guys able to run that scam?
All the rest of the summer. The rest of the summer.
So that's a good 6 weeks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Till the beginning of September. Now, I quit before they demoed Task Force 6.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd pretty much at that point had pretty much had enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't as poor as I was when I started that spring after being out of work all winter.
Yeah.
And, And then some buddies of mine from the Aleutians said, hey, we're putting a crew together. We're going to go fishing, you know, fall fishing. Why don't you quit that oil spill crap and get back to work?
Okay, so...
So then I did. I jumped. I was, you know, even as comfortable as I was at that point, you know, there on the task force, I wanted to get out of there. I couldn't wait. So when they offered me a fishing job, I was done.
Was it about feeling slimy or was it about feeling fear?
Oh, no. No. If I had run into policemen or law enforcement at that point, it would not have been my first time in my life.
Yeah.
I was just sick of it.
Yeah.
I was just sick of doing it, and I was sick of those guys. And, you know, I mean, if you were in with them, like I said, it was just about the most comfortable situation you could. But, you know, you had to crap on a lot of other people.
And you had, and you could only take so much of sleaze bags.
That was it. Yeah. You know, it was just, well, see, at one point, I'm hauling all this booze out for them, or having it hauled out for them, you know, kind of thing. But then, and you see, all these guys are you know, good old Southern boys. And we had a couple. Matt was one of them. He was my lead man. In fact, I tried to just get him out of the way. But they were Rastafarians. Uh-huh. And I'll tell you, those Tennessee, Texan, Louisiana oilmen could not abide a Rastafarian to save their life. Their very existence on the task force irked them. And we were tossing their room constantly because they were on my crew. So we were trying to get rid of them. You know, they submitted them to lice checks and to, they had to have their hair checked for lice on a weekly basis. They searched their room every week, you know, kind of thing. I mean, they were just constantly harassed. I never knew what happened to Leon, but Matt, I knew, wasn't going to last very long, and I really liked Matt. Still do. We're still friends. He lives about 15 miles down the road here.
So
I hit him out. I said, Matt, you know, you deserve to be, you know, a crew boss foreman, you know. But I said, you know, every time Warren sees you, it chaps his ass just a little bit more, you know. So that's why Matt was running the beach crew for me, because it was out of the way.
This is the slave thing you were talking about.
No, that was the Indians. About halfway through the oil spill, handles that, but somebody came up and told all these upcountry Indians that if they didn't get down there and get a job on the oil spill, that they were going to cut off their assistance. And these guys couldn't winter, you know, without their assistance.
And when you say upcountry, you're talking about...
Well, it was everything. There was a bunch from here all the way up to Minto.
Okay.
We had a bunch of guys out of Minto Village and stuff like that, but you couldn't get them to do shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were there under duress. You know, uh-huh. They were there because they didn't want a job there. You know, they wanted to stay up in the village. But, you know, the ultimatum was you either go down and get a job there or we'll cut you from assistance.
Yeah.
And which there's no way that they could live through the winter.
Yeah.
You know, like that. But so when you got them on there, you couldn't fire them. You know, you couldn't weed it out and find the ones that were actually willing to work or anything. And we were always getting in trouble for them. You know, as soon as you sent them back to Valdez, they just got reprocessed through, and you saw them again 3 days later. You know, and so they just ended up riding boats back and forth. So you couldn't fire them, and you couldn't do anything with them, really. One guy I had was so bad, and it was bringing the rest of the crew down, you know, but he wouldn't do anything. And so finally, of course, like I said, it's all about perception out there. And all the white hats, none of them ever hit the beach. You know, of course, by the end of the summer, I wasn't even wearing rubber boots. I was wearing my cowboy boots because I never hit the beach either. But unless I absolutely had to. But anyway, this guy, I just couldn't get anything. And I was getting a bunch of crap. He's just standing there smoking cigarettes, you know. And but all the white hats, all the supervisors are out on the water. And they're just scanning the beach. Like I said, they don't even really know what anybody's doing.
Yeah.
As long as they're just not standing around smoking a cigarette or eating a sandwich all day long. So I took a poly line and I tied it to a rock. And I took that line and I swung it way out in the water. And I gave it to him. And I said, all you have to do is stand here and hold this. Smoke all the cigarettes you want, eat sandwiches, drink soda. Just stand here every once in a while, tug on this line a little bit. End of the problem. He got what he wanted, and they got off my butt because he wasn't standing around. You know, as they scanned the beach, they saw an Indian holding a rock, holding a rope. They didn't know it was tied to a rock out there.
So what's your best guess? Why were the natives so lazy? Is that just the nature or their whole dislike of, you know, of this tragedy that had happened virtually?
They couldn't have cared less about it out there. Mm-hmm. You know, they just didn't want to. That's not their lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, they hunt, they fish, and they live in the village.
Yeah.
You know, we're sandwiched between several villages. Yeah. I do not want to sound bigoted.
Half my family are Alaskan
natives.
Well, exactly, and that's why I ask, because I want to frame this so that it actually flatters them. They were made to do it.
That was not their lifestyle. They didn't want to go out and work for those oilmen.
Yeah.
And you know, some of them really got into it, you know, kind of thing. But the money was just the same. And the money was not important to them. Their mm-hmm. lifestyle was what was important to them. So when you drug them out there and made them do all that crap, they were just pissed.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't like it.
Right.
They were, like I said, they were there under duress.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool.
It was either you go do that or we cut you off from all your income through the winter.
Okay, we're on the same page as that. That's great. Now tell me about the Rastafarians. What the hell were they doing there in the first place?
Making money.
That's just in the scope of so many different types of people volunteered. I mean, by volunteered, I mean came to Valdez to get jobs.
Yep.
And so...
most of the people that went out, at least, even on the first crew, you know... weren't from Valdez. Mm-hmm. Maybe half of us. But that dwindled down really, really fast, too, as they found better jobs. A lot of people wanted to go back to Valdez and work, mm-hmm. you know, because then you get to stay home and, you know, that kind of thing. I wanted to work out on the Sound. I loved the Sound. Fished out there commercially and sport, you know. You know, so that was just my general environment, you know.
Right.
But most of the people that worked out there weren't from even... anywhere near Valdez.
Yeah.
The original foremen and stuff that they brought up were a bunch of the oil rig guys out of Homer and Kenai.
Yeah.
You know, that had lots of experience running crews and not oil spill cleanup, but at least, you know, ship mobilization and, you know, running crews and stuff like that.
So what was the predominant ethic or point of view or... way of being that how you could characterize one of these Exxon white hats?
They just had to keep the show rolling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that was it. The Exxon supervisors, their deal was to just keep the show rolling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it never had anything to do with the effectiveness of the program. None of it did. And it you know, I mean, we got that right off the bat.
Yeah.
You know, it was just to make a big production. One day, just one day. I mean, and we were, towards the end, we were dreaming up all kinds of silly shit to do. You know, one spot on Seal Island, we had $1 million airlift. One day, we spent just a bunch of us, I got pictures of it too. We just got together and we were like, oh, nobody can get up to this side of Seal Island and we can't clean these rocks and blah, you know, all this stuff. So we just dreamed up it. One of the guys, he was an Exxon guy that they brought up from down south, and his name's JW, and he got up every morning, and as we were mobbing up, he was like, let's spend some Exxon money, and that was all, you know, that's what it was just a big production, just a big show. So we helicoptered all these pumps up onto the beach, and we had boats standing by, and we spent $1 million that day. And
didn't accomplish anything.
No, we cleaned up maybe a quart of oil. That's all. But it didn't matter. Yeah. They were getting pictures of helicopters bringing in equipment left and right. We mowed up the beach like it was Iwo Jima and ran people all over the place. And yeah, everybody got a hell of a lot of good footage out of it. Went back happier than crap. And we got our quart of oil.
And
but that was only $1 million that day.
And what beach was that? Do you recall?
That was on Seal Island.
Seal Island, okay.
Yeah, that was on Seal Island.
Well, it sounds to me like we got the story here, John. I mean, I have to condense. I have to condense all of this down to about 1,200 words, and believe me.
Holy moly.
Yeah. So, I'm sure you've got a lot more to tell, but I think that what we got here is a great story. So I'm going to turn it off, okay?
Fine.
Okay.